are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Problems, problems, problems all day long. Will my problems work out right or wrong? My baby don't like anything I do. My teacher seems to feel the same way.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial. We live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Prus. If you want to call into today's show, we're at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255. And with that, it's a Wednesday, and I have Nick Nugent in the studio with me here. It's been a long time.
It has, since February, since we were on the air together.
Yeah, you've been making all these mistakes and putting on the wrong calendar.
I have.
Or was it me?
You know, we just need to...
We need people.
To
realign our schedules, yeah.
That would help.
So, what were you doing?
Well, I taught a class at the OLLI program at UAF on the Haynes and Kanawha pipelines. We had a friend, it's been a friend of mine for about 60 years, come up and visit. He lives in Chattanooga. He wanted to see Fairbanks in the winter. Well, he came in March, so I told him
a beautiful time to come.
It is. I told him he had missed winter, though. So we took some time off and just had a very enjoyable spring.
Good for you. So what is today's subject?
Today's subject is the gold strikes at Atlin, which was British Columbia's last strike. Atlin it's south of the general alignment of the White Pass Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
The Big Lakes down in southern Yukon and northern British Columbia, Atlin was down in there. The easiest way to get there would have been to go to the railroad station of Log Cabin, and then basically turn right, and you end up over at the diggings. So it was the last rush in British Columbia. It was not the last rush in the north, but it did come on, right on the immediate heels of Dawson. So in the years before, the area of Atlin was very remote, very unknown. The early explorers and traders were basically there for furs. And one of the reasons that they were confined to the coast was topography. It was terrible getting over the mountains till White Pass, Chilkoot, and some of the others were discovered. But also the Tlingit were very, very jealous of
hostile.
The trade monopoly they had.
Yes.
And they were not willing to give that trade monopoly up. They didn't care who went where as long as they had all the trade. The Western Union Telegraph, if you remember, we had talked about them maybe a year ago, and they brought their efforts to link Europe and North America up. They made it as far as Telegraph Creek in central British Columbia. Well, they were going to go through across the U.S., through British Columbia, Yukon, Alaska, and Siberia, on to some European place in Russia, where they could tie the lines together to reach all of Europe. That was 1867. So the first Westerner, European, that's thought to have seen Lake Atlin was Michael Byrnes, and he was scouting a route for the Telegraph. He was kind of an interesting guy. He was very, very good at prospecting, incredibly good at route finding, but he was not literate. So he never wrote anything down. Fortunately, he had an excellent memory, and he would come back and dictate to people the routes he had found.
Okay.
So even though you won't see anything by him much in writing, Schwatka and George Dawson were both quite aware of his travels. And on one of Schwatka's trips, he was looking at some of the original trails that Byers had used. Well, The Telegraph Project, if you remember, came to a sudden halt in 1867 when the transatlantic cable was laid. It just wasn't necessary to go three-fourths of the way around the world to put in the telegraph. Gold, of course, had started 1849 in California, moved north from there. There was a caribou rush in British Columbia, started in 1858, and by 1867, it had pretty well run its course. People were moving on. There were posts of the Hudson's Bay Company, though they really, at that time, discouraged miners. They knew when a lot of miners came in, the fur-bearing animals would leave or be used up, and they knew how to make money off of furs. They weren't sure how to make money off of miners. So they'd
figure that out real fast.
And there are, interestingly enough, still in the archives, there are occasionally maps found of the Hudson's Bay Company produced to places like Atlin years before it was thought people may have went there. So if somebody ever had a lot of time and wanted to do probably a little bit of a painful project, going through the Hudson's Bay archives might be productive for some of the history of southern Yukon, northern BC. Well, Schwatka, Lieutenant Schwatka, whom we've talked about, first came north in 1883. He entered the Yukon drainage by way of the Chilkoot Pass, as most did at that time, White Pass being the much steeper and harder to travel by foot. He returned in 1891, expected to use the same route, while in Juneau he was persuaded to try a route up the Taku to where an old native trail led to Teslin Lake. And he did that, and he ended up fairly near Atlin Lake, although he didn't stop to investigate. Between Schwatka's two trips, the Canadian government sent a party of their geologic survey, led by George Mercer Dawson, who, of course, Dawson's named after. He passed along Tagish Lake, just to the west of Atlin, and never explored the Taku Arm, but from talking to locals, he described the Atlinu River, which he understood from what the local natives told him, came from a bigger lake they called Atlin. So finally, they're beginning to place where Atlin Lake is, and this not to the 1890s. A lot of prospectors and miners were coming north from the Cassiar country, which had finally was pretty well petered out by this time. Dawson went away believing that a strike was imminent. He was a little ahead of his time, but not by much. But everything he saw and the number of people coming through, he was predicting a major strike somewhere in the Yukon drainage. He also was the first person that realized the Yukon headwaters must rise out of Atlin Lake. Well, the records then...
Did he realize that before he ever really discovered Atlin Lake?
No, he picked that up from kind of getting a general geography of the lakes and rivers and what the natives could tell him about places they went. Okay. And so he just kind of pieced it together.
He knew it without seeing it.
He did.
Wow.
Some of what Dawson discovered, though, is interesting because it led to the Canadians' Geological Survey and the U.S. Geological Survey don't agree on the start of the Yukon. The Yukon will be a slightly different length if you look at the records from the two surveys.
Okay. Well,
miners were coming into the area by the 1890s then, and they basically were headed for the Yukon drainage. But in amidst all that, some started to look at other areas while they came north. Those especially that came up the White Pass, although the White Pass and the Chilkoot to Log Cabin, they'll both take you to Log Cabin. Well, two men from records, Frederick Fritz Miller and Kenneth McLaren, were the first to file a claim officially, although there's a lot of conflicting stories about discovery. One of the most well-documented is a butcher named Murphy driving sheep to Dawson, noticed a nugget where the sheep had churned up the bank of a creek they were climbing. And he stayed to mine. He traveled to Bennett to buy supplies. And pretty soon, people begin to notice that he's paying for everything with brand new, freshly mined gold. So he was followed back, and that brought some miners into the area. But the Millers, older brother George, had went through the area. He owned the Circle City Hotel with Lockie McKinnon. And a rather romantic story says that George took in a dying prospector who gave him some nuggets and a clear description of where they came from. He was in the Atlin Valley from about 1890 to 1896. He drove cattle up to the camps, prospected along the way. He's pretty well thought to be maybe the first discoverer of gold, but his last trip, he never filed a claim. He never returned to the area. His last journey was very arduous. He was being chased by natives, by the Tlingit wanted to run him out of the area. He broke bones in a fall, and he got married when he got back, and he was a newlywed, and he very likely found the comforts of home preferable to the trail.
Those were the end of his wandering days.
They were.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Hello, I'm William Shatner. Blood Bank of Alaska. As the sole blood and blood product provider in the state of Alaska, BBA provides blood products to virtually every hospital in the state, including all tribal and military medical facilities. We ask that you donate today. Your blood or platelet donation can save your fellow Alaskan's life.
This message brought to you by the radio station 529 Fifth Avenue. Mountain View Eye Center is excited to welcome Dr. Jason Crosby to the team. Dr. Crosby is an experienced ophthalmologist who previously served as an eye surgeon in the U.S. Air Force. His specialties include cataract surgery, LASIK, medical eye care, and more. Dr. Crosby is now accepting new patients. Call today to schedule your appointment. Call 907-328-2920. That's 907-328-2920. Mountain View Eye Center, located just off Pegger on Phillips Field Road. Visit them online at mountainvieweyes.com.
Get your garage back, people. Been parking outside all winter? Need to store some items ASAP? Christian here with Independent Rental to tell you about your storage solution. We rent 20 and 40 foot storage containers on-site here at South Cushman, or we'll bring it to you. We have the extra space you need. Brand new storage containers with prices starting at $150 per month. Call today. Independent Rental Storage. Safe, secure, affordable.
The Outdoor Show, sponsored by Camper Valley RV, is happening this weekend at the Carlson Center. No matter who you are, we have something to boost your Alaskan summer fun factor. Check out the newest outdoor recreational equipment, plan a hunting or fishing adventure, get travel ideas, all this and more, including the Interior Alaska Gun Show. The Outdoor Show, this weekend at the Carlson Center, $5 for adults, 12 and under free, and military or anyone bringing two cans of food free on Sunday. The Outdoor Show, sponsored by Camper Valley RV and the radio station.
Weather brought to you by The Woodway. Toyotomi oil heaters have warmed interior Alaska homes for decades. Efficient, quiet, and reliable. Buy yours today. The Alaskan way. The right way. The Woodway.
KFAR Weather.
Sunshine mixed with clouds at times today, with daytime highs approaching 55. Winds out of the east, 8 to 15 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 31. Tonight, mainly cloudy skies expected. Daytime highs approaching 59. Tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sun. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here. If you have a question or a thought, we're at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255. And we are talking about Atlin. The last gold strike.
It was.
The British Columbia area, yeah.
You might have thought it would have been discovered earlier. It was close to the coast, but it was just really people didn't realize it was there. You look from Bennett and some of those areas. It's a pretty formidable range of mountains you're looking into. Well, Fritz, then, was only 24 when he came up in 1891 after his parents had died to join his brother. Both Millers were actually in Circle City during the 1894-95. George had some business interests there. They returned to Juneau in the summer of 1897, and they had stopped in Dawson in 1897 and didn't see enough to make it worth their time to stay. So that kind of interesting, since that's when discovery was actually happening there. They missed it. They entered the country then when they came back in 1898. Fritz and his partner McLaren came back from the stories George had told him. They had a pretty good idea where they needed to go. In 1898, February, they came up through the White Pass. They swung east to Tutchie Lake and then on to Tagish. There were other people in the area. There was actually a party of surveyors. They saw those surveyors and turned to avoid them because they didn't want people to know where they were prospecting. And that was fortuitous. They went to a creek they named Pine Creek for all the evergreens in its valley. They were quite a ways up the creek. It turns out what we see as Lake Atlin today, the old historic shore at the time of deposition was 450 feet higher in elevation. So a lot of water's gone out of there from the last deposition age. So the gold tends to be on benches on the old, old shores and the old mouths and deltas of the creeks from that period of time. They started sinking shafts. And
you know, you have to be a part geologist to be a successful miner.
Absolutely, and certainly to be able to understand what you're looking at.
Yeah.
And how did this deposit get here? And was it, you know, scrubbed over by a glacier? Is it a water deposit? Yeah, takes a number of years to learn those skills.
Yep.
Well, they started sinking shafts, and on March 25th, they discovered gold about 6 feet deep on Pine Creek. That became known as Discovery. Their next two holes hit gold at 4 feet, then 3.5. Well, their provisions were dwindling, so they went back to Juneau, reported to Brother George and his partner McKinnon. They took just 11 days to get back on the claim because they realized time was at an essence here. They decided again to use White Pass because just 2 days prior had been the rather famous avalanche over on the Chilkoot Pass that killed the 60 prospectors, so they didn't want to go that way. They were moving among the early prospectors, headed to the Klondike, and they built a boat at Lake Bennett, set off. But when they got to Tagish Post, also known as Fort Sifton, that's where they kind of, when nobody was looking, veered off. Went around the lake and went on back up to Pine Creek. They arrived there on June 4th. They had all their camp built, were set up, and had their rocker boxes going. And they started production on July 3rd. They were netting $120 a day between the two of them. That would have been excellent return for any miner in 1898.
Oh, yes.
So they knew the discovery wouldn't remain unnoticed for very long. There's a lot of other people just wandering. You know, they begin to hear that maybe Dawson's not that great. Dawson's a long, terrible way away. Maybe I should look around here. So more prospectors were coming into the area. In June of 1898, a prospecting party had their boat swamped, and they reached Miller and McLaren's camp. They saw the smoke and came up. Miller and McLaren fed them, and they took back off. They returned to Juneau. So people started coming from Juneau. A man named Jim Greenslate had maybe the most interesting story. He arrived in their camp one day, and it turns out he had had a roadhouse just past the scales on the Chilkoot Pass. Three of Soapy Smith's men came up to sell him some protection for his business, and they got in an argument, and he was a apparently, Greenslate knew his way around a revolver and got the drop on him and dropped the three of them and then realized, well,
Soapy's better be gone now.
Yeah, Soapy's got a pretty big gang. It's time to move on.
Yeah.
So he went on over to Atlin, where he'd heard rumors of people being. So they staked. He staked claims also. In July, the rumors began to circulate that the Pine Creek, they were got over to where all the crowd going to Dawson. What had happened, some natives had come through the camp, seen what they were doing, went over to Bennett to buy supplies and asked some of the miners, you know, why you go all the way to Dawson, plenty of gold over here. And so that was the end of keeping the secret hid. They brought another party of relatives up from Juneau, and these early claims were going to end up being a source of a lot of dispute. The government officials in Canada thought Pine Creek was north of 60 degrees, which would have put it in the Yukon, which means it would have been run under the laws of the Northwest Territory. The Northwest Territory allowed 1,214 feet of creek bed, non-discovery claims 250 feet. The BC laws would only allow 90 feet. So when that all came together and they realized what had happened, all kinds of claim jumpers moved in and overfiled everything.
Yeah.
The reason being, nobody knew exactly how much the miners on site, they could choose what they were willing to relinquish. So they just overstaked everything around them, knowing, okay, fine, you've got to get rid of two-thirds of this. Somebody's going to get it. And that was a problem for a couple of years before that was all sorted out. Well, they found that that was the case when the gold commissioner at Bennett began to realize that's, you know, from where I know I am here, that seems like it's a ways away. So he hired the surveyor who was surveying the route of the White Pass to go over, and yes, they realized that they were about 35 miles south of 60, so they were well in BC and would have to follow the rules of that province. A lot of people headed over. Many headed for Pine Creek. Many went to some of the other creeks around. They saved 600 miles of travel to Dawson and were certainly a lot fresher when they got there.
Yes.
Yeah. It created such a rush, though, that even cooks made $15 a day.
Oh, my goodness.
Which was a lot of money in its day. The workers building the White Pass, most of whom had only planned on coming up and getting a steak and moving on, left in such great numbers. Probably 1,500 of the 2,000 employed. And unfortunately for the railroad, not only did the workers leave, they took all their picks and shovels and buckets with them. So now the railroad's short on equipment.
Only in America.
It's kind of the story of the Northern Gold Rushes, isn't it?
I know it, goodness. Oh, boy. And Fairbanks, what we're going to do now is we're going to take a commercial break. We're going to give you some... bumper music, Madonna, Holiday. Then we're going to have some Fox News, some state news, some commercials, and some weather. But before we get to Madonna, I got to make a comment on our music here. You know, it's Melissa, and she's putting Madonna on here as bumper music. Oh, my God. And this is what she's doing to me tomorrow. You know, my favorite radio station is River. And she's barking at me. She's giving me some Black Dog and Led Zeppelin at 6:15. And I always tell her that's a late afternoon evening song. But she's just rubbing it in. So she's putting Madonna on my show, and she's putting Black Dog early AM on my radio station. She puts me in a room with purple padded walls with North Korean equipment. It's just tough sometimes, but we will persevere. We'll be back after these messages.
Problem. Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Chuck Schumer says the Republican impeachment efforts against DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas ought to be dismissed, but the Senate will go to trial. The leader says that two impeachment articles that Republicans sent him have no merit.
Senators will provide as jurors in the least legitimate, least substantive, and most politicized impeachment trial ever in the history of the United States.
Well, these articles accuse Mayorkas of not following border laws, misleading the public about the border being secure. The House GOP Committee on Education and Workforce with a hearing on allegations of college anti-Semitism. Virginia Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott says college anti-Semitism reflects what he says is a divided and bigoted nation.
We should not feign surprise at hate speech on America's college campuses. The fact is that college campuses are polarized.
America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Fairbanks Daily News Minor reports that Alaska is home to more than 20,000 homeschool students, but funding for those students is now uncertain after an Anchorage Superior Court judge ruled that state funding cannot be used for private education expenses. Last Friday, Superior Court Judge Adolph Zeman ruled that a 2023 Alaska law is unconstitutional. Alaska Statute 14.03.310 states that parents of students enrolled in private or public correspondence schools may use funding allotted from the state purchase non-sectarian services and materials from a public, private, or religious organization. This court finds that there is no workable way to construe the statutes to allow only constitutional spending, Zeman wrote. Lon Garrison, director of the Alaska Association of School Boards, said the amount of funding that public correspondence programs receive will not change due to the ruling. What will be vastly different is that parents won't get direct payments and they won't be able to go purchase curriculum or programs on their own, Garrison
Streaming
said.
Live online at KFAR660.com.
The Surgery Center of Fairbanks. Doctors Neil Everson and Mark Wade of the Orthopedic and Sports Medicine Clinic of Fairbanks are excited to bring to Fairbanks the Mako Robotic System, the first robotic-assisted knee and hip replacement surgery technology. This is the most advanced robotic technology on the market, and your joint replacement surgery will be supported with the industry's leading technology that has become the gold standard for robotic joint replacement surgery. If you, a friend or family member, think that hip or knee replacement surgery is an option, call the Orthopedic and Sports Medicine Clinic of Fairbanks.
Well, summer will be here before you know it, and you want to enjoy it. Well, so do the folks at Septic Specialists of Alaska. They want to fish, hike, camp, and have fun too. So don't wait until the last minute when they're full for the summer. Get on the books now, whether it's servicing your septic system or a new install or replacement. The key here is don't wait until it's too late. Get on the schedule now so you can go have fun this summer. Enjoy your Alaska summer with help from Septic Specialists of Alaska. Schedule an appointment today online at SepticSpecialistsOfAlaska.com.
Glass Doctor is known as the home, auto, and business glass shop. But what do we mean when we say auto? That means we can fix or repair your vehicle's windshield, door, side, and back glass, and we can even come to you. With our G12 road hazard guarantee, you can rest easy knowing that for 1 year we will repair or replace for free any damage that may happen to your windshield. For home, auto, or business right here in Alaska, check us out online at www.glassdoctor.com.
Call the Glass Doctor, we'll fix your pain.
It would be great to have $10,000. But better than that, having $10,000 and helping the Yukon Quest. Yukon Quest raffle tickets are now available for purchase. Tickets are only $100 with a chance to win $10,000 cash and other prizes. The cost of the ticket includes delicious appetizers and a marvelous time at the North Pole Ale House. Tickets can be purchased at Ivory Jack's in the Elks Lodge or at the Yukon Quest office in person or over the phone. There are only 250 tickets available, so get yours today.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I'm going to give you a PSA announcement, and here we go. Unused and expired prescription medications are a public safety issue. Proper disposal of unneeded drugs saves lives and protects the environment and overall community. National Drug Takeback Day is coming up on Saturday, April 27th. Help Fairbanks Police confront the drug problem in our community by bringing your old and unneeded medications to the Fairbanks Police Department at 911 Cushman Street for proper disposal on Saturday, April 27th from 10 to 2 p.m. There you go, Fairbanks. Anyways, did my public service announcement.
I think that's a very good program. You know, having grown up in the 70s myself.
Yeah, with all the drugs, yeah. I would have been, yeah, in the 70s, we all had our public drug service, you know, disposal sites, I'm sure.
Yes.
And Second Avenue was Fairbanks.
I seem to remember there were people, if they saw a pill laying on a table, I better take that.
You know, if there's one thing, not for me. Just.
Yep. Doesn't seem like a good long-term prospect.
No. When I was a freshman in high school, I had shin splints. And so they gave me this medication. I couldn't play basketball for about a week. And they gave me this medication. And when I was done with the medication, I couldn't get to sleep at night till about 3 a.m. for about a week. And I was like, forget this. You know, I've never forgot that. Even in my college days, a bad hangover, there was no bear aspirin for me. Just forget it. You know, you did this to yourself. Ain't no pill going to help you, buddy.
I had a little bit the opposite when my appendix ruptured. I was put on opiates, mm-hmm. and I sat in the hospital, and I got hours of pleasurable reading out of the stop sign outdoors.
Ah. When I had a hernia operation here about 4 or 5 years ago, they gave me 3 painkillers for a week, one opiate and 2 non-opiates, and I didn't take a one. I did not take a single painkiller. Just powered through it, you know, and I was fine.
Very good. Well, the Discovery claims in the early days, Discovery claim continued to produce $60 or so a day per man working. The laborers around the area were earning as much as $12 a day. And every time, the newspapers just went crazy with the strike. They tried to make this strike look like the easiest one to get to. The White Pass was going to be there. They were kind of giving the idea that if you stepped on a boat in Victoria or Vancouver, you weren't likely to even see mud till you got to the claims. One of the things they did is every time a woman went through the area, there'd be a big story about, see, even women can do this. It's so easy. Well, Atlin City and Pine City were still tent towns. Neither had a sawmill until October. It is estimated that 3,000 prospectors arrived, and production for the year 1898 was reported at 3,750 troy ounces worth $75,000. So there was some easy, early to get to. These were the so-called poor man's claims, mm-hmm. where pick and shovel work did everything for you. Discovery claim, even before being registered, in addition to the 3,700, produced 2,350 ounces before it was even registered.
Wow.
Most of it was done with rockers, the old method, yeah. because there was a lack of water everywhere in this area. The steep creeks that snow would melt, they'd drain down, and they used rockers and caught the water and kept recycling their water quite a bit.
Best way to do it.
So the Klondike was known to have no more room for newcomers by this time, so the Stampeders headed for Atlin Lake and Pine Creek. Many thought, how lucky can we be with this new strike right in our laps? We're ahead of all the guys that have to come back. The best route was by ship to Skagway, up the White Pass. The George Brackett's wagon trail was in by this time, and the White Pass Railroad was being built, so it was starting to get to be the easy way. And even over on the Chilkoot Pass, an aerial tramway had now been built, which made that arduous task of carrying everything up the pass easier for those people, of course, who could afford to pay for the tramway. Thousands of horses were tried over the White Pass. That's a pretty well-known story. Most fell to their deaths. Hay was $45 to $150 per ton. The horses were pretty much fed whatever they could find, and they fared very badly.
Oh, boy.
They had a lot of, when the horses fought, there was one place where a lot of horses were lost, that it was easy to get to the bottom of that particular cliff. The horses would have pack loads, and they'd brush the side and bump them over, and there was a man opened a tent up not far away and had a sign on the front, and he offered meals and fresh meat for $2.50 a pound.
Oh, God.
So, again,
Hey, you know, nothing like a mother of invention during a crisis.
That's a fact. Most still pack their own belongings because the cost of trams, packers, and horses was out of reach. Their personal loads remember the 1,000 pounds, so if somebody tells you you've got 600 less miles to carry 1,000 pounds, that's going to make that strike look pretty good. Accommodations were quite primitive. At Lower Fantailed Lake, at Old Cockney, ran a little restaurant in a tent, of course, and his menu consisted entirely of and only of coffee and ham sandwiches. And that's because he could get coffee. Yeah, it came in bags. It was easy to transport. And hams didn't spoil very quickly. Well, an English doctor, after taking that trip, found out that at Taku City, on the other hand, there was a full-menu Japanese restaurant with meals for only 75 cents. An English doctor, Roger Hicks, noted that all he wanted, though, on the trail was a good meal, a cigar, an easy chair and a book, maybe some good port and a good bed, and he allowed to how not a one of those things could be found on the trail.
No port?
No.
No cigar, no books? Oh, man.
By 1899, things had improved, though. The railroad had reached Bennett, and it was much easier to get freight over. It could come down the arms on Taku Lake. And then there was a short railroad built by the White Pass that crossed the isthmus there. And the locomotive off that railroad still sets down in Carcross, the Duchess, if you ever see pictures of the Duchess. So it drug everything the last little bit that boats couldn't make. The Atlantic City of the news headlines didn't actually exist when the season opened. It was still taking shape. It was a tent town. Some of the better establishments sported really elaborate false fronts and then were entirely tents behind. Two sawmills were operating, and with firewood, the local forests were receding pretty rapidly, just like here. The sawmills were the most profitable business going. One of the bank presidents said the worst idea they had was to open a bank and not bring...
not a sawmill?
Not a sawmill. They operated 24 hours a day, couldn't meet demand. Customers arrived at dawn and waited, cash in hand, for their orders to be finished. They would not accept anything other than cash. So at Discovery, also known as Pine City, 10 miles away, similar building boom, prices there were just as high. Lumber cost $150 per 1,000 board feet. The previously mentioned Dr. Hicks had to pay a carpenter a dollar per hour to build a small cabin for his business on Discovery. The completed structure cost $64, and Hicks said it was comparable to a prison cell. Hicks, because he was not a citizen of BC, unfortunately wasn't allowed to use his building and practice medicine.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Discover the power of a John Deere compact tractor from Craig Taylor Equipment, ideal for Alaska's tough terrain. Ready to face any challenge, they'll help you shape your land to reflect your vision. With great financing options available, you don't need to settle for less. Visit Craig Taylor Equipment in Fairbanks and see how John Deere can transform your property. Craig Taylor Equipment, celebrating 70 years as your Alaska-owned and operated John Deere dealer. Call 907-452-1192 or check them out at CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
Are you ready to get out of the house? Want to go outside and enjoy summer in the last frontier? Well, now you can do it and save big. On Friday, May 17th, starting at 8 a.m., it's the Spring Alaska Radio Auction. We'll have gift certificates from some of your favorite local and statewide businesses that will be selling and auctioning off for pennies on the dollar. These certificates are for some of your favorite activities like kayaking, biking, fishing, and more, plus restaurants and hotels in Anchorage, Homer, Seward, and more. And if you're a local business owner, come join us on the auction. You'll receive lots of exposure for your business, an advertising bank to promote your business, and a bunch of new customers, all for no cash money. If you'd like to participate, just call 907-451-5910. The Spring Alaska Radio Auction, live on air and online Friday the 17th, starting at 8 a.m. You'll save big money at our big spring auction. Now you can plan the perfect Alaskan summer adventure for half price. Go to AlaskaRadioAuction.com for all the details.
KFAR weather.
Sunshine mixed with clouds at times today, with daytime highs approaching 55. Easterly winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Mainly cloudy skies expected tonight. Lows dip down to about 31. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 59. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here, and he's bringing us up to date on the last large gold rush in the British Columbia area, which was around Atlin Lake and Pine Creek.
Yes. Quite a... If nothing else, it was probably one of the more beautiful areas to have a gold strike.
Isn't that a beautiful area? My goodness. You know, oh, man.
I'm afraid I'd have to really force myself to look down rather than gawk at the mountains.
Yeah, or remove a tree. Also, I'm an environmentalist.
Well, by the fall, when people begin to leave again, the estimate was as many as 22,000 prospectors had come into the area. But the reasonable amount for people who stayed was probably 6,000 based on miners' licenses issued, 1,500 in Atlin, 4,500 on the creeks. There were still signs, though, that things weren't as rosy as they had originally expected. Pine Creek was the easy creek for about a mile, mile and a half on either side of Discovery. After that, conditions changed rapidly. So remember we talked about the gold at 3 and 4 feet, coarse nuggets.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the early miners didn't even try to recover fine gold. There was so much coarse gold there. They just let it go back into the stream beds.
Oh, man.
And it just wasn't worth setting up the effort to recover.
Yeah.
And imagine that today.
you're getting every fine
that's right.
Tooth out of it.
If you can see it, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Well, as they did that, they also found that on maybe one creek, Pine Creek, would have this easy to come by gold. The next creek over would have 5-6 foot diameter boulders, a lot of gold, but 20 feet under the boulder layers. So that began to get to the point where you had two types of workings going on. The poor man's and the big hydraulic mechanical operations. So the nature of mining changed fairly quickly in Atlin. 1898 and 1899, maybe 1900, were the years of the individual miner. The individual miners did outproduce the companies until around 1902, 1903, but only because the companies were doing a lot of ditching, bringing equipment in, getting set up. So a lot of their season went to just simply getting ready to mine.
Mm-hmm.
They took over by 1903 and were the way to go. The main hindrance was the government. And the reason for that was, like I mentioned, the government had misunderstood where the claims were. The gold commissioner they put in place was not particularly good. His Captain William Ramp, who was the gold commissioner at Bennett, appointed his son Norman. And the younger Rant was best known for being notoriously inefficient. He had 1,700 claims that had been staked, many not properly recorded. He'd forgot to order the recording forms. And people were walking around with basically a scrap of paper instead of an official receipt. And that, of course, caused more trouble later when all the lawsuits hit. He also worked to help himself and a group of developers to some of the land the government was setting aside for town sites. So he was falling out on the bad side. He didn't handle the oversized claims well, and the government established a gold commission to look into it and had a very well-respected mining engineer, Joseph Graham, come in. They set up a program, begin to actually process everything well. The Canadian government, though, in the middle of this, decided that too much of the profits were going to Americans, just like in Dawson, and they wanted to stop that, just like they wanted this to be an all-Canadian route and Canada first. They passed a revision to the mining laws, which allowed mining licenses to be issued only to Canadians. So U.S. capital dried up, miners left, the mining economy shrunk by two-thirds. Another big spate of claim jumping ensued, and many U.S. miners, one of the references I read said, quietly armed themselves. So they were
ready for claim jumpers.
They were, yeah, they were going to dig in, much like they did elsewhere. That act was struck down in 1900 as being an overreach by the provincial government. The Canadian federal government struck it down and said that that was a map, since it involved immigration and the arrival of miners, it was a federal issue. Those 15 months, though, seriously impacted Atlin as many miners went to Nome. Finally, the provincial government put in another gold commissioner. And the hearings weren't underway, though, until June 19th, which was well into the mining season. That caused a lot of resentment because the miners had to leave work to show up to protect their claims. Plus, each of the plaintiffs was charged $25 to help cover the costs of the government's blunder. Eventually, the issues were worked out, and agreeably to most of the Canadian, American, and English interests. Claim jumpers, though, stayed busy filing protests on any technicality they could find. So there was a lot of legal work that really held Atlin back. One of the references said Atlin was harmed mostly by government too far away to understand what they were doing. I've never heard anyone say that before.
Me neither.
Well, all the activity on the creeks continued. The gold in Atlin was worth $2 to $5 more than nuggets from the Klondike. It was nicer sized gold, and it had a very desirable color for making jewelry.
As you say, it sounds like jeweler's gold.
Yeah, it very much, very much was. Dozens of creeks were staked, which never produced. By 1900, there were about 1,500 to 2,000 miners working the whole district. And very few of them, though, left with pick, shovel, wheelbarrow, and rocker box. But at one point, men with just that equipment were producing $40 a day. Fritz, the discovery claim, recovered 55 ounces after 40 hours work by five men. The least productive claims, $15 a day, when $2 a day was a fair wage. And so the creeks, though,
were worth going into, yeah.
They were worth going into, but more and more by mechanical means. Pine Creek, the discovery, was the anomaly. Almost everything else there was much harder to come by, or the gold was drifting. A lot of it was down to 25 to 30 feet, which is pretty much the extent of what you can drift. A lot of problems with water coming in. Well, some large ditches were built, one of which could carry 15,000 miners' inches of water. That was the best capacity in all of the North at that time. Atlin Consolidated was bought out by the Guggenheims, became the largest operation. They sold out in 1914. And during the First World War, the area slumped. A lot of major consolidations took place in 1918. Spruce Creek had been staked in 1898 first. The original reports were all pessimistic. And it turns out that for drifting, that turned out to be an excellent mine. 200 to 400 miners were working there prior to the First World War. Spruce Creek turned out actually to be the banner creek of the district once some mechanical and hydraulicking operations got in. It, because of the boulders, never produced well for the dredges. They tried a couple and set them elsewhere. And just simple large jumbos and hydraulics were the way to go. 1902 had some unfortunate events. There was an anti-Asian sentiment, which led to a labor incident where 15 Japanese miners were run out of the district. The gold commissioner actually added anti-Asian regulations to mining licenses. But by 1907, there were small numbers of Japanese working in the remoter locations. There was no grumbling, though, eventually when people realized labor was in such demand that Japanese were depriving nobody of jobs and wages didn't decrease. Atlin, interestingly, never had an official local government. In the early days, the main political power was the British Miners Protective Association. Benevolent societies and fraternal groups, as well as miners' unions, worked to resolve issues. The most enduring group was the Board of Trade, who often acted as a quasi-town council. They were promoters. They were the mainstay, but the general public was encouraged to attend meetings. They undertook road repairs, fire protection, issuance of business licenses. There were no complaints about any of their activities. They were quite transparent. The Arctic Brotherhood, the Masons, the Ancient Order of United Workmen, and the Moose also all worked to try to make Atlin a good place to mine and to work. The White Pass Railroad around 1914 had started promoting Atlin as the Switzerland of North America. That, of course, died out during the war years, but came back in the 1920s. There were a lot of first-class resorts built. The White Pass had some very palatial lake boats, not river boats. And things
it transitioned.
They went very well, and that is Atlin today. It's based on, there is a road in to Atlin from the Alaska Highway, and it is a trip worth taking. If you're going down the road, it's worth swerving over. There are a lot of preserved buildings, and it's just a very, very pleasant remnant of the gold rush.
Okay. That was very good and interesting. In fact, I'm going to text a friend of mine to drop into Atlin this afternoon on his drive up this this summer.
I think you'll enjoy that,
So what are you thinking about in May?
Well, I was thinking that maybe the Alaska Railroad. We haven't done much with railroads. We've done air transportation a few times. We could either do the Alaska or the White Pass. Do you have a preference?
Let's do the White Pass. It came first.
It did.
Yeah. And then later on in the winter, we can do the Alaska Railroad.
We can. And that also, the White Pass will give us a setup for the Copper River because of Michael Haney, who was the general foreman on both projects.
It'll give me time to research White Pass and know some stuff.
Well, I have a book that was published by Roy Minter years ago, if you'd like to take a look at it. It's a very excellent history of the White Pass.
I'll give you a call and get that from you. So you're done with teaching for the year.
I am.
Or the semester
anyway.
So all of a sudden you're Professor Emeritus.
Oh, that's a good way of looking at it.
What do you got planned for the weekend?
Oh, well, like we spoke about, we'll go to the outdoor show and see how the weather turns out.
It's supposed to get in like the mid to high 50s and if not 60 this week. So when it hits 60 above, Perry Wally pulls out the shorts. I was sort of chiding him today saying, where's the shorts? And he goes, it's not 50 above yet. And I said, you're being a wimp. You got hairy legs. Come on now. Get the shorts on.
I have a friend that he's in his 30s. He is in shorts every day when it's above 30 below.
So right down the hallway. So yes, so it's VMAX. Boy, tattoos and all. Fairbanks, you have a great day. I will see you on Friday. Nick, thank you so much, sir. I greatly appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.